summer of the report. But the summary is not as helpful as the report itself. And mind you, that if we use the summary, we will just be skating over things. Now the question I want to ask is it not possible that you speak to the report, the original report, other than the summary? Because the summary will just eat our time without actually addressing the issues that you have well addressed in the report.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. The summary is prepared in accordance with the guidelines we got from the Justice Committee before. The previous committee, when we regurgitated the report as is, there was a complaint from members that they have read the report. We should zero in on aspects that we want to zero in on. So the summary is extracted from the report, but we're also honorable chairperson, and we took into account the fact that we informed that we have 20 minutes.
I hear what you are saying. All I'm saying is that the summary is really general impression. It doesn't get to the issues that we need to address. And I think you have addressed the issues very well in this report. My request would be, why don't you speak to the report other than the summary? Because the summary won't take us anywhere.
I'm in your hands, Chairperson. I will try to follow the summary, and to the extent that there are questions on the report, I'll go into the report then. Because the summary has been extracted from the report.
Let me really place on record that this meeting should address issues where we feel that we should be able to guide you and so on. But your summary is really saying things are being addressed, but we don't know which things, how are they being addressed, and so on. But you produced a good report. And is your report, you should know what is inside. Why don't you simply speak to the report?
I said that, Honourable Chairperson, I will do so as guided by the summary, because I do need a roadmap, and I do need members to be able to focus on something at the top. Thank you. Is it over to me, sir? Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Thank you, Honourable Members, for this opportunity. Firstly, may I take this opportunity to express my sincere condolences to Parliament for the passing of the Honourable Watson, and also to take this opportunity to express my condolences to the family and yourself and his colleagues, particularly the DA. Honourable Chairperson, my well wishes to the Honourable Jackson Tembo, who is also in the hospital. Thank you. My delegation, Chairperson, is Advocate Kevin Malunga, the Deputy Public Protector, Mr. Mamelezi Gula, the Acting CEO, Mr. Lucas Zepe, the Acting CFO, Mr. Opa Sekhwalwe, the Acting Spokesperson, and Ms. Benita Young, Parliamentary Liaison. And I take the opportunity to indicate to Parliament that our CEO, CFO, and resigned all with effect from the 1st of October, and we are in the process of trying to fill those posts. The opportunity to present our report is sincerely appreciated. I'm going to ask that we go to the summary that we had prepared. The year at a glance is in the report on page 14. The mandate of the public protector is as expressed in the report. And our service promise, which is our strategic objective, is also based on the report. Our work ethic is in the report, where we talk about how we approach things. The triaging process is something we thought would just explain how we decide what we're going to take. The sixth thing that we put for your observation is remedying injustice, which again we have examples of cases inside the report itself, and we will be talking about how do we remedy injustice. Again, item number 7, Honourable Chairperson, is strategy number 9 in the Public Protector Report. Strategy number 9 says ensuring the implementation of remedial action. And that is a strategy that has been approved by this Parliament, and we've been using the same strategy for the last 5 years. Making an impact, we're summarizing some of the cases that we've dealt with that's dealing with corruption and malfeasance. 8, making an impact. We're giving an analysis on those top 10 organs of state, which are expressed on page 15 of the report, Honourable Chairperson. 10, making an impact through leveraging oversight and stakeholder collaboration. This is the strategy here on promoting good governance. The part of our work there is how do we link up with fellow institutions to ensure that we do better, and we maximize our impact. 11, injustice and remedy. It speaks to where we have failed to comply with strategy number 9, because there are organs of state that are either taking us to court or just telling us that they are not going to do anything. Number 12, make an impact. The South Africa's African Renaissance peace efforts. We're talking about the work we're doing on international relations, which is in the report, work that we're doing under IOMA, IOC, and the IOI. Number 13, audited performance information from April 2013 to 31 March 2014. That speaks specifically to the 5 strategic objectives, the targets we've set for the year under review, and the extent to which we have met those targets or not met those targets, and our explanation to you as the oversight body what the reasons are for the non-achievement of some of those strategic objectives. 14 is inadequate and auditor performance information. That was a request from Parliament that we should talk to information on our performance from the 1st of April to the 30th of September 2014, and specifically they talk to performance information as to the strategic plan. So it's unaudited, but it's raw information on the strat plan. The key challenges and what are we doing to mitigate them, it is in the report. We're giving you a summary. And 16 conclusions and appeal to Parliament. We're summarizing the parts that at the end of the day deals with the challenges that we have and how we're requesting Parliament to assist us. I will then, if there is other parts of the report that somehow get skipped because of this, I will rely on Parliament assisting me with this committee assisting me. So in terms of the report, we're starting on page 14 in terms of the presentation. That's our first slide. Our performances in the year under review, we handled 39,817 cases. From those cases, 13,622 came from the previous year. We finalized 24,642 cases. The cases that we did not finalize in the year under review were 9,564. All I can mention there is that the number of cases carried over was reduced because we had focused on attacking the backlog, which is something we're currently doing now. Unfortunately, as well, attacking the old backlog, we created new backlogs because new cases are part. The cases we received that year were 26,195. You will notice there, honorable members, that already we finalized 2,000 cases less than the number we received, because we received 26,195 and we finished 24,642. Well, it's not really 2,000, 1,500 or thereabout cases that we more than we could handle just from that financial year before we talked about the backlog. We referred about 3,072 cases to institutions such as the Public Service Commission, Inspector General of Intelligence, the Judicial Inspectorate of Prisons, the Military Ombud, and the Tax Ombud. Cases that were rejected because they were non-jurisdiction cases were 3,014. During that year, honorable members, our budget was a little under 200 million. It was 199,253,000. The total staff during that period was about 314, and that includes 100 trainee investigators that you will notice in the report that were not funded fully. We had received funding the previous year and we carried over a bit of that money into the financial year under review, and the rest we had to find from our own budget. The second slide is the slide we have, honorable chairperson, on page 15 in the report. We've reproduced it on page 2. It's still the year in a plan. there we are just focusing on the key departments from which we got our reports from. 31% of the reports came from municipalities. That is the main slice of our report. The second slice, bigger slice of the report, came from justice and correctional services, but not from the department itself, from the service centers, such as the master's office, the maintenance court, and the clerks of courts and registrars that are dealing with cases. The highest lines came from municipalities. The second highest, I'm sorry, Honorable Chairperson, was human settlements. The third highest was Department of Justice. The next one was education at 10%. 31%, 13%, 12%, 10%, and then home affairs also took quite a significant part at 10%. Then at 9%, we have the South African Police Services. I must indicate there, though, that a lot of those cases would be reflected in the referrals because they would have been referred back to the IFED or referred back to the Civilian Secretariat of the Inspection in the South African Police. There are others that fed into the complaints were the Department of Health, the Department of Agriculture and Rural Development, the Department of Transport and ESCOM. But just to say, the bulk of the cases are municipalities, and in some slide later, I delve into what are the kinds of cases that are principally being brought to us from municipalities. The mandate, vision, and mission of the honorable members. Now we're getting into the meat of the report. In the report, we have page 23 where we give the strategic overview. That's where we talk about mandate, strategic plan, etc. In terms of the mandate, as the public sector of South Africa, we remain on course in the pursuit of our constitutional mandate, our additional statutory mandate, the vision, mission, purpose, principle, values, and our service promise. Our constitutional mandate, which comes from Section 182 of the Constitution, is as follows. The public sector has the power as regulated by national legislation.
Isn't it true that when you appeared before us before, you read all this? So is it necessary to repeat it? Can't we take it as a know what the mandate is, what section is, and then we just go to the issues?
If that's okay with members, we can do so. Just to indicate again that the mandate remains as the chairperson has indicated. Exactly as it has always been. That is the constitutional mandate, honorable members, to investigate, report, and take appropriate remedial action. Just to highlight that an unknown part of the mandate is that we are required to be accessible to all persons and communities. That's Section 182.2. Additional statutory mandates remain the same. Our vision, which was articulated in 2010, remains the same. We've never changed the vision part. The mission, we have never changed it. The only thing we added a year ago is our purpose, which we said we're conscious of the state to act with integrity and fairness. Our principles remain the same. Our values remain the same. Our service promise has not changed. It remains the same, which is our five strategic objectives. And again, with these ones, maybe I would just repeat them, to be accessible to all persons and communities, to ensure prompt justice, including remedial action, to promote good governance in the conduct of state affairs, to ensure that we are an effective and efficient organization, and to ensure optimal performance in a purpose-driven culture. This is the strategic plan that was adopted by this committee and eventually adopted by Parliament at the beginning of 2010. The only thing that has changed over the years was that we included justice on strategic objective number 2. It used to be just prompt remedial action. We then changed it to add prompt justice, including the remedial action, and that change happened 2 years ago. Our work ethic is to, we continue, honourable members, to balance universal accessibility in compliance with Section 182.2 of the Constitution with promptitude and rigor. So there's three things we try to do at all times: to be accessible, to be fast, and to be rigorous, and often the balance is difficult. The bread and butter cases continue to be given priority and under two tracks: the early resolution track that is led by the Deputy Public Protector. The service delivery track also deals with bread and butter cases, but are the complex ones. And we only have one that deals with corruption, malfeasance, and violation of ethical requirements, and that is done by the Good Governance Branch. These branches are replicated throughout the province. With constantly worsening resource constraints, the balancing of universal accessibility, promptitude, and rigor gets tedious every day. Deciding what we take and what we prioritize, we did show you the slide, honorable members, last time, that we don't just take everything that comes into us. We have a triaging process where we decide it's a non-jurisdiction. We can decline even if it's not a non-jurisdiction, if it's coming to us too early or we don't think the complaint has merit. And then we refer or accept. So there are four ways we can deal with any complaint that comes to us. If we accept it, it can go to the early resolution branch or it can go to the investigation branch. If it goes to early resolution, that's where most of our time is spent. Even though I supervise two branches, service delivery and GGI, the early resolution matters also take a substantial portion of my time because that's the bulk of our cases that we resolve. The early resolution can be resolved through a phone, through email, or ADR is sitting around the table. The final result is a closing report, unless it complicates, and then we investigate it. When we investigate, we issue ordinary reports or formal reports. And if they're not happy with the closing report, they can go back. We've created now a whole customer service branch, which is part of our intake assessment and customer service branch. And they can complain to that branch, which will review it and then advise me on whether or not to reopen the investigation. Once the investigation has been done by myself, we don't review it because I consider myself functus officio. Slide number 6, honorable chairperson. We continue to ask the same questions when we investigate. What happened? What should have happened? If there's a discrepancy between the two, does it amount to maladministration? If so, what would it take to place the complainant, people or situation as close as possible to where they would have been? In terms of the annual report, honourable chairperson, at page 29, before we go into cases, just trying to balance your request with the approach I have adopted. And On page 29 of the report, before we go into cases, we give you a situation analysis. We say, Honorable Chairperson, that the year 2013-14 was the fourth year of implementing the Public Protector Vision 2020. That is the one we adopted in 2012. And then we say that the strategic plan, which was revised in December 2012, took account of the achievements that we have made then. And again, our strategy remains anchored in five key strategic objectives. Efforts are made in ensuring that our finances and human resources are aligned to these key strategic objectives. We must admit, however, that the office experienced enormous challenges in respect of resource alignment, and we indicate that this will be addressed in the report later. The next issue we address the Honourable Chairperson is accessibility. We say accessibility is central to our strategy, and because it is informed by the constitutional injunction to be accessible to all persons and communities. We say, pursuant to this constitutional requirement, various initiatives were undertaken in the year under review. These include outreach activities where we tried to reach 10 million and in the end we reached 30 million. That's not direct contact, Honorable Members. It is also indirect contact through radio, television, newspapers, and social media. Our direct contact efforts, though, have also increased through our mobile clinics and information sessions. We will talk to the specific numbers when we get to the right part of the book. On investigation, we derive our mandate from Section 182 of the Constitution, which gives the public protector power to investigate any conduct in state affairs or in the public administration in any sphere of government that is alleged or suspected to be improper or to result in any impropriety. The Constitution gives the public protector to report, the power to report on that conduct and to take appropriate remedial action. Then we talk about additional power. You will forgive me for being a little bit repetitive because now I'm trying to comply with the request that we deal with the report specifically.
Now you are free to present as you please, only that you have 20 minutes. So make sure that however you present, your time allocation is 20 minutes remaining.
Thank you. In that regard, Honorable Chairperson, I would request that I try to just go through the slide, and then when I have extra time, I go to the parts of the report that may be of interest to you. Thank you. We go to slide 7 of the presentation. There we have included for your attention some case studies. We say the enemy is maladministration, and when we keep our eyes on it, we all win. And we're giving you, Honorable Members, and hopefully government as a whole, examples of how, through the joining hands with organs of state, we've been able to give people hope and restore their trust in the mechanisms created to give them an opportunity to exact accountability and to vindicate their rights. We have the case of a grandmother who got her pension payout. The pension was owed from about 2007, and it was the Department of Health. There was a dispute around what was the period of service, because she had served at the University of Ndunza at a particular time, and then went into the Department of Health. And the matter had been going backwards and forward, backwards and forward. We conciliated with the Department of Health, and Mrs. N has been paid her pension eventually. It was a very, very painful story because her husband had also retired and they needed the source of income. And for many years, for more than 5 years, the money was not paid. It has since been paid. The other one is a homeless in RDP housing victim. It's a case where the victim got the house in the Eastern Cape, and the house was given to her. She stayed there. She participated in deciding what the house should look like. And when the house was finally built, she stayed there. After a few years, a municipal employee came and said she owns the house. And when she followed through, the municipal employee also had documents that showed that she had been given a grant for that house. Both of them had documents. The municipal employee eventually sued her, got a court order, and evicted her. And for more than 5 years, she's been homeless. We conciliated with the municipality and said it was its fault that she had to be evicted because the house should not have been given to two people. And in any event, the day she was evicted, she should have been provided with alternative housing. The grandfather who got paid for work done after more than 5 years, it's a municipal case of a business person who hadn't been paid his money since 2007. So we conciliated this matter. And they were claiming that he had cost them their tractor, but then they hadn't paid him all the money they owed him without dealing with the tractor issue separately. We conciliated with the municipality and he got paid, not exactly what he was asking for, but what was there in the circumstances. It will not resuscitate his business because it was too far down the line, but it was some kind of consolation. We had a case of a student who was owed an allowance. She went to study in Australia, didn't get an allowance. We conciliated with the department, of Education in one of the provinces, and eventually, even though she's back in the country, she got paid. In one province, we had a community that was claiming that it as a group, a colored community, had never been given RDP houses. We said with the mayor, he admitted that that group had not been given any houses, and he promised them the new development that was going to take place. In the report, we have the following reports that we brought to your attention on the impact of systemic service failure on peace and security. The children shall pay, and here's in the report. That is Oliphant's food. The impact of systemic service failure on human rights, that is learning without books in the Eastern Cape. The impact of systemic service failure on developmental objectives, we discussed in the report our Millennium Development Goals hearings on poverty and health services. And there are several cases that you will see in the report, honourable members, where we deal with excesses in executive benefits. In the report, honourable members, we draw to your attention what needs to be taken into account in terms of what are the fault lines that we picked up. We picked up unnecessary procurement, and we gave you an example of the 15 million that was spent for an internal disciplinary inquiry. Undue deviation from IDPs, where projects are just started, and then the ones that were planned, then suffer. Overbilling, false billing, short service delivery, scope creep, obscene project cost escalation, and so simple malfeasance. We will talk to the methods to do that. Making an impact. I'm going to rush into what are we doing to maximize cooperation. We have MOUs, we are encouraging the establishment of new ombudsman offices. The profile of our cases, honorable members, we want you to know that is changing. Whilst we are experiencing growth, the growth is not in those areas where we are disengaging, like the military, the police, the prisons, etc. It's new areas of maladministration. And I must also indicate that in terms of numbers, we compare well with our colleagues. I looked at Canada, Ontario, about the population is smaller. They got about 27,000 cases in the same year. Injustice unremedied. We just want to bring to your attention strategic objective number 9, that there are cases where for the first time we've experienced some resistance to implementation, which is creating problems with complainants relying on this channel. There's a mining rights case which is called a missed opportunity. The department said the minister has exercised executive authority and the case is closed. Then the Department of Home Affairs agreed under Minister Dlamini to implement unconscionable delay. And then when a new minister came, she reversed that decision and the department is now taking us on the team. On the pension fund, it's a story of people who were who suffered an injustice because of regulatory failure by the state in moving them from one social security scheme to another. The one was a defined benefit scheme. They ended up with one that was not a defined benefit scheme, and the report was written in 2012. We're still negotiating implementation. That's the only one where there isn't resistance. There's just question marks on what we're going to do. We ask you to note our peace efforts. Contribution to peace efforts through IOMA and the African Ombudsman Research Center. Now, the audited performance information is on the actual report. Then, honorable chairperson, the audited performance information is on page 66. On page 66, just to help members deal with the report. It starts on page 60, that's the audited performance information. From our side, we just gave you highlights of the number of mobile clinics that we did, 1,979. We reached 37 million people. We did stakeholder engagements. We hosted Good Governance Week. That is on accessibility and trust by all persons and communities. On prompt justice, including remedial action, we've indicated that we exceeded our targets in terms of the 50% resolving cases, half of them within 3 months. However, when it comes to completing everything within 6 months, we have experienced problems, which I will indicate in a little while. On strategic objective number 3, promotion of good governance and conduct of state affairs. In the actual report, strategic objective number 3 starts on page 66. Not page 66. It starts on page 73. Again, we just gave you highlights to say we have 100%. technical compliance means that we advise the president that we will not be able to complete in 30 days, but proper compliance, which is substantive compliance, we're struggling because we don't have personnel, enough personnel. We had, again, the Good Governance Week. We're asking you to note a declaration that was facilitated through funding provided by the Department of International Relations and Cooperation. It's called OR Tambo Declaration. We had a summit, and that declaration was adopted as part of our promotion of good governance and conduct of state affairs. But it also boils down to our international relations with strategic objective number 4, which is an efficient and effective organization. We had an unqualified audit with reduced matters of emphasis, but we'll discuss what the problems are. We have developed action plans and are implementing them to address the audit findings. We had an ICT strategy that has been developed and implemented as planned. However, the case management system remains something that is work in progress. The last strategic objective is strategic objective number 5. A optimal performance and service-focused culture. We have developed and are implementing a human resource plan. We have been doing employee satisfaction surveys and then identifying the deficiencies and responding to those. We have done benchmarking visits primarily around investigation techniques and the case. We presented you the information on the first and second quarter of 2014 to 15, and it's in slide number, it's not in the report, Honorable Chairperson, it is in slide number 14. No, it's on the slide. I'm sorry, it's not slide number. It's on slide number 22. Yes. So we ask you to just note those, that's the new performance information that is not in the report. If you want to ask questions on that, what are key challenges? Our key challenge, Honorable Chairperson, is resources. The resource issue has received a crisis point. I have indicated previously that when I came to this office 5 years ago, we already had a resource problem. That's why Parliament had approved a new organogram, which had 432 posts. That organogram was never implemented. The workload has increased since then, and the complexity of the cases has increased since then. We then had a structure that was approved by the Minister of Finance for 556 posts. When we then asked for the money, then the Treasury said we should finance it with our own money. By then, we already had a deficit, and Parliament had noted the deficit. That new structure that was approved in 2012 has 556 posts, and currently we have 314 posts. That include posts for trainee investigators, and the trainee investigators post we only received funding once, which was the supplementary funding that you receive in the last 6 months of the financial year. They are now eating into our posts. We have tried cost-cutting measures. For example, this year we don't have a good governance conference and good governance week. We are doing that virtually using the internet and social pages to cut down. Our stakeholder, you may have noticed that this year we didn't have a vibrant stakeholder consultative process. We consulted, and then we're using the dates that we're going to use for other events. If we're invited into a province for something, we then combine it with a stakeholder consultation, and we combine it with our national key dates. we've cut down on various things internally. We can address Parliament on all of the other things that we've done to try to reduce our costs. The reality is that the organogram needs to be implemented. It was approved by Parliament. It was approved by Treasury. In other countries, when something has been adjudicated as necessary for an ombudsman, you get the money, and we ask Parliament to assist us in that regard. It's affecting our performance, and it's getting a lot of complainants that are angry, because when we're dealing with one case is put down. The other area where we need your support is on the issue of remedial action. We drew your attention to our strat plan, which was approved by this Parliament 5 years ago. In that strat plan, we have said prompt remedial action, including prompt remedial action, it was changed later to prompt remedial action, including justice. We would ask for assistance in that regard. And strategy number 9, which again was approved by this committee of the National Assembly, specifically says ensure the implementation of remedial action. So we've been pursuing those things, and we're getting a bit of resistance, and we will need assistance in that regard. We draw your attention to the fact that the NDP, Honourable Chairperson, on slide heading number 16, the NDP has said that the public protector and other institutions supporting constitutional democracy will be strengthened through additional skills and resources as part of our anti-maladministration and anti-corruption strategy. So we would be appealing that the implementation of the NDP be invoked by this committee to get Treasury to give us the necessary money. We thank you for joining hands with us in seamless oversight, and particularly holding state actors accountable for their actions. I just want to thank through this committee the Speaker or Acting Speaker of Parliament, who wrote to me last week giving me an assurance that Parliament fully supports this office and would like to see it perform its work effectively as envisaged by the Constitution drafters, and also undertaking that should I feel that the office or myself have been insulted in the performance of my work, I should directly approach Parliament and request a proper process in that regard. Of course, I have indicated to Parliament that from my side, I will be invoking Section 9 of the Public Protector Act, which prohibits contempt of the Public Protector, which includes insulting the Public Protector or the Deputy Public Protector, in the same way that contempt for the courts is prohibited. Lastly, we invite you, Honourable Chairperson, to participate in the stakeholder dialogue on joining hands against maladministration and corruption. Where possible, we would invite yourself or members of the committee to participate. And if your very busy schedule permits, we could have a dialogue here in Parliament around what do we mean about joining hands. Again, I've just returned from Berlin, where most of the people who are doing similar work that we are doing, from New York to Honduras and Eastern Europe, is preventing impunity. The emphasis is on strengthening synergies to prevent impunity, particularly between the public protector and prosecution. And then on our side, of course, the impunity also includes remedying injustices, not just worrying about the corruption issues, worrying about Gogo Dlamini, who approaches this door for recourse, gets a report in her favor, and then doesn't get anything out of it. We ask you to ensure that Treasury provides the full 24.3 million requested for 2014-15 supplementary funding and 61.1 million. However, during the question time, Honourable Chairperson, we'll talk about the budgeting thing, because the acting CFO and acting CEO have looked at the budget and said, if we're going to address the deficit, last year we had a deficit, what do we do? At the request of us as management, they have done that. And they've come with a proposal that says the way forward is that forthwith we cease operations. They have allocated the budget to cover all of those items. And then the way forward would be to cease operations and do nothing, and just collect our salaries. And then, well, of course, we would do limited operations, such as telephone work within our offices, but nothing more than that. But still would have a deficit, and the acting CEO will explain that we would still have a deficit even if we did that. The budget is under enormous strain, Honourable Chairperson. And then just lastly, last slide, Mr. Durbin, to just thank everyone. I have indicated, Honourable Chairperson, that we have difficulty with the implementation of remedial elections, but that's not the norm. That is an aberration. The norm, Honourable Chairperson, is that organs of state are working with my office to ensure the implementation of remedial action. I've given you examples there on this new slide that we've ordered, because we're worried that we may be sending a wrong impression that government is not complying. Government is complying. There are aberrations. We're just worried that the aberrations could become a norm if they're not addressed. Examples, we've just issued a report titled Ubuntu as part of that, the two quarters, first quarters of this year, where Umfolozi Game Reserve was found to be acting improperly in terms of not securing the game reserve enough and not compensating people for certain violations. The KwaZulu-Natal government accepted the findings, even started offering certain amounts for compensation. We've just said no, the amounts should be reviewed by an expert to make sure that people get a fair amount. Mpumalanga government on people, pilgrims rest, poison processes, we asked that the tender process be started afresh. That was accepted and it's been done. City of Cape Town in Nickmin Court, it's a Gogo Dlamini kind of case. The city agreed to compensate a victim of an electrical surge. Free State government in Nala, it's a systemic investigation into various forms of maladministration at Nala municipality, and we issued a report called Pipes to Nowhere, because literally there were pipes to nowhere, where they had paid for a system there that had pipes that were not going anywhere. That was their sewerage system, and then there was sewerage everywhere when we started there, and there's been implementation. There may be problems here and there, but there is commitment to work with us. Thank you. Sorry, Bua, Siabonga, Rialeboka, Baya Danki. And as long as there is injustice somewhere, sustainable peace can never be experienced anywhere. And through joining hands against maladministration, we can ensure that there is justice, and therefore we all enjoy peace. Thank you.
Thank you, Public Protector, for your input. And I hope that members have noted the requests that you have made, and that they will be addressed. But before I open for discussion, allow me to assure you, as the acting the speaker did, that this parliament and this committee in particular are not supporting you as a favor, it is a constitutional imperative that we should support this institution, because it's an important institution in strengthening and supporting the constitutional democracy that we are enjoying today. And it is in that spirit that we welcome every opportunity to meet with yourselves, so that where things are not clear, we can also be clarified, so that we support you with understanding. In particular, I want to refer to your report, which says that you are accountable to Parliament through the Justice and Correctional Services Portfolio Committee. We fully understand and support the independence of the Office of the Public Protector. But when it comes to accountability of the office to Parliament through us, I think we haven't had time to unpack what that means. Because, for instance, your report says you have completed more than 20,000 reports, but we haven't seen a single report at this committee. And what these reports are dealing with. And now we hear that you have difficulty in getting the remedial action implemented. And we think that that difficulty should not have arisen if we have a common understanding of accountability, because after completing the reports, if the reports were to come to us, we would note the remedial actions that you expect state institutions to observe. And because we have a duty, primary duty, to hold departments, state institutions to account, we would get them to explain to Parliament why they are not complying. But we are not able to do so because we are not informed. So maybe you can assist us to explain what is your understanding of accountability to Parliament. What does it consist of? Because if Parliament doesn't get reports from your office, how do we then assist? Secondly, you are requesting that we help you with the enforcement of remedial action. If you could actually assist us as well, what would be the difference between corrective measures recommended by yourself, directives made by yourself? Are these directives and corrective measures the same thing as remedial action? Are these binding on Parliament, or what is the status of all these measures? Because unless we have that a common understanding, we won't be able to assist you, but otherwise you can be rest assured that we are here to make sure that we support your office, because without that support, we will ourselves be endangering this constitutional democracy, and we cannot do that without violating the will of the people of South Africa that elected us to be here. So if you, before we open, if you can just guide us on those two issues, accountability and remedial action. Thank you.
Chairperson, can I request that the Deputy Public Protector be the one that responds to the question? You know, there is sometimes this notion that the Public Protector is actually a president, but this is an office. If we could just ask the Deputy Public Protector just to take this question in particular, and of course the Public Protector will beg on it.
That's our understanding, that we are dealing with the Office of the Public Protector, not a
Chairperson. Sorry, Chairperson, I think this is highly irregular, a request. Obviously, it is an office, but there is the Public Protector, and if she chooses to answer the question of this committee on behalf of the office,
then it's not in our ambit to force another member of her office to answer. This has not been done to any of the other accounting institutions during the course of this week, and for one, I don't think it's within our ambit to silence the public protector in favor of the deputy.
Honorable Horn, I have not made any ruling of that kind. I only said that this office, this committee, recognizes the office of the public protector, and that's what the Constitution says. The Constitution has created the office of the public protector. So where is the problem? Proceed.
Honourable Chairperson, thank you. I will allow the Deputy Public Protector to answer, since that's the preference of one member, but I will then supplement the answer. Just to explain, though, that the Public Protector and the Auditor General are both an organization and a person. There is only one Public Protector.
Public Protector, can I just assist?
I just wanted to clarify.
Let me just explain. There is no ruling that you should not respond, and the Honourable Member was simply saying that the Deputy should participate, not to exclude him. So respond as Public Protector, you respond as the Deputy where he needs to, there's no problem, let's not debate that matter.
Public Protector, please answer the question, I will supplement your answer.
Thank you, Chair, Honourable Members. We actually have had an interesting discussion on this particular issue under the ambit of the Forum of Institutions Supporting Democracy. And we are more than willing to avail to the Honourable Members a draft of how we understood accountability and what accountability means. We considered largely the understanding that Parliament has of what its oversight role is. And it's a very comprehensive document that Parliament has come up with. I'm sure honourable members have seen it, of what is the meaning of oversight. What is that meaning? What does that entail? And so what we understood ourselves to have is complementary oversight in terms of the law, in terms of the structure. I understand ourselves not to be a fourth arm of the state. In other words, we are essentially part of this process. We're part of the parliamentary structure, from our interpretation and from what Parliament sees itself as being. In other words, there's an institution supporting democracy. So an accountability is very clear in the Constitution. Obviously, we cannot be a law unto ourselves. That's one thing I understand accountability to mean, which is why we are here, which is why the public protector, myself, are appointed upon a reflection of processes from this particular committee. So my understanding is that it's a cooperative arrangement where, obviously, by all means, we are supposed to assert our independence without fear or favor or prejudice, but have a situation where we assist Parliament in exercising its oversight over the executive, holding the executive to account. That's the framework that I understand to mean. So, and obviously, in terms of just like any other entity, Chapter 9 entity, and of course, other entities from the state, we come here and explain how we spend our money and how we conduct our operations. Are we in line with what we were created for? Are we overstepping the mark In other words, are we taking work from the Auditor General or from the Human Rights Commission? Certainly, if that is so, Parliament has a right to say, you know, hold your horses there. But independence is not negotiable. Independence of these institutions is not negotiable. It is in the law. It is clear. So, I mean, well, a very interesting thing that came out from that discussion within the forum was that there's obviously an interesting dynamic that says, on the one hand, you are independent and you must conduct your work without fear or favor. On the other hand, it says you are accountable to Parliament. So it's a very dicey sort of dance, if I can call it, that has to be done. And then my understanding really is that we really are here to actually exercise complementary oversight, assist the National Assembly in holding the executive and government to account. And that's basically the understanding that I have. And with regard to remedial action, this is a very contested terrain right now, which I suspect that a court of law would probably provide the greatest clarity as to how far it goes. Obviously, the challenge that ombudspersons all over the world have is the fact that our power is somewhat on the soft side. We cannot say, like a court of law, you know, you are directed to do this by X and Y date. So that's the challenge that we often face. But certainly, it is in the best interest of the people we find against most of the time to implement, because most of these findings for remedial action are well thought out, well reasoned issues. And I understand that there's a lot of excitement right now about the big issues, the highly sensitive political issues, but 99.9% of the work that we do has nothing to do with famous people with big cases. And that's something that the media has not highlighted, that, you know, we are out there protecting the small person. So in those cases, usually the remedial action, finding that someone must get their pension, finding that someone must get a house that they've been promised and so forth, is not a very difficult thing to implement. So I think we probably will have to get back to the drawing board in terms of that one. It's still up in the air a bit, but I think the idea of remedial action, really, from my understanding, is that we make these recommendations and findings for the people who are affected to take them seriously. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and thank you to Honourable Member. Thank you to the Deputy Public Protector for the answer. Indeed, I will agree with the DPP on the issue of reporting to Parliament. It is clearly regulated, not for the Public Protector, but for all Chapter 9 institutions, for members of the Executive, and I have noticed it is also provided for in the Public Service Commission, which is a Chapter 10 institution. The wording is in Section 181.5, Honourable Chairperson. It says, these institutions are accountable to the National Assembly and must report on the activities and performance of their functions to the Assembly at least once a year. That is why we are here today. We also report to you when we present our strategic plan. Other offices similar to us, depending on the statute and the circumstances, report to their parliament quarterly and activities report. But you are asking on what about the reports of the public protector? Those, Honourable Chairperson, are regulated by Section 8 of the Public Protector Act. And let's go to Section 8 of the Public Protector Act. It says the the protector's name, subject to the provisions of subsection 3, in a manner he or she deems fit, make known to any person any finding, point of view, or recommendation in respect of the matter investigated by him or her. The public protector shall report in writing on the activities of her office, his or her office, to the National Assembly at least once a year, provided that any report shall also be tabled in the National Council of Provinces. So that's again a very activity. When it comes to now the reports which are not the stick report, the special report, subsection 2B says the following: the public protector shall at any time submit a report to the National Assembly on the findings of the particular investigation if, one, he or she deems it necessary, two, he or she deems it in the public interest, three, it requires the urgent attention of or an intervention by the National Assembly, four, he or she is requested to do so by the Speaker of the National Assembly, or five, he or she is requested to do so by the Chairperson of the National Council of Provinces. The system I have found in the office that is operated since as of late last year is that only special reports or formal reports are shared with the National Assembly. And we have not failed to do so. Every special report that we've issued, a formal report, we send it to the Speaker. But it would appear to us, Honorable Chairperson, that there might be a problem in those reports coming to us. There's no report we've never tabled to the Speaker, except any report. Any is the Executive Members Ethics Act. That's the only act which deviates. In the Executive Members Ethics Act, the act very specifies there, I think it's section 3 of the report, that the report of the MA must be submitted to the president. And then the president, within 14 days of me submitting the report to him, must submit the report to Parliament with a copy of his comments and indication of what he intends to do with the report, with the findings, or what he has done. So I have complied with the law. On the MA, submit the report to the president, and it has happened in the Speaker. I can show reports previously where the first report I did, for example, the president, the Speaker wrote back to me, and all of the reports we've done with ministers, the Speaker would then engage me on after the president submitted the report. But on the ones that I do, even though the act says it's discretional, all of the reports, the national ones, are submitted to Parliament, and the provincial ones are submitted to the provincial legislature for notice. The municipal ones are submitted to the Speaker of the Council, because there's no implementation of a public protector's report. I would differ slightly with the wording that says recommendations, because again I go with the law. I tend to be a stickler for complying with the law, because our constitution was drafted after a careful examination of wording from ombudsman institutions. And the drafters of our own constitution chose to ask the public protector. I don't want to personalize it, Honorable Chairperson. I just want to say I tend to focus on the law, not differing with any person. Just say the law, the Constitution says the public protector has the power, is regulated by legislation, to investigate, report, and take appropriate measures. The Public Protector Act, which I just read to you, specifically considers a recommendation as one of many options. We do recommend where we deem appropriate. In other words, You asked me, Chairperson, and you said, you did these 24,000 reports, why didn't we get them? That's the place where we make recommendations. Because as we see that, no, you treated Gogo Dlamini badly, we recommend, we negotiate, we conciliate, we say, you fix it this way. If you fix it, we don't write a report. When we write a report, we would have reached a point where we are now making a determination of right and wrong. And we make a finding. My sense of it is when you make a finding, you're making a determination of right and wrong. You're saying you were right or you were wrong. And in some cases, the parties allow me, they negotiate and they agree on certain things. And they say, okay, this we agree with each other. It's going to be part of our settlement, written settlement. But on this one, you make a determination. We will go with your finding. There's an M&M case, for example, that is not a published one, where half of it is conciliated and there's agreement. And in that agreement, there's also a submission to the powers of the park protector to say, adjudicate this part in powers of the park protector. And it is true that the letter is now before a court of law. Again, the court of law will make its own determination. But until a court of law makes a determination on letter, we are enjoined to adhere to Section 39 of the Constitution, which is Section 39, Chapter 3, the Interpretation Clause. In that, the Interpretation Clause says when we interpret legislation, we have to take a purposive approach. And in my engagement with academics and lawyers, I've gone back to saying, what is a purposive approach? Just nugget of the FCA.
I'm not sure we should go into debates that are not yet conclusive. I think you have answered us. The only concern that would remain, which we don't need to address here, is according to the Public Protector Act, if a matter is in the public interest or requires intervention, you are expected to refer it to Parliament. And now it is a matter of concern that if you are right, and I think you are right, in saying there are state institutions which don't want to implement your recommendation or what you call remedial action, that should be a matter of public interest, because that would amount to non-compliance with the requirements of the Constitution. Now, the question would be, why don't you regard that as a matter of public interest that should be referred to Parliament?
Honourable Chairperson, when each report is issued, we send it to the Speaker for noting, but not as a referral to request a debate, because at that stage we are hoping that the institution is going to implement. When we have engaged with the institutions and members, and they are refusing, that's when then we must then write to the Speaker and invoke Section 9 of the Act and say we are requesting that Parliament debate this matter. And that's standard with all of the institutions. But we do have to send these reports to you for noting all of them. What is emerging is that seemingly these reports are not reaching the committee. What I will ask Ms. Young, that a copy then be sent to the chairperson of the portfolio, but will indicate when it's for noting, because it doesn't mean every time we issue a report we want Parliament to debate it, because it may well be that they are going to implement. When they refuse to implement, that is then, I mean, in the UK they just debated four cases of my colleague, and because of non-implementation. I also just want to indicate that's part of the reason why I refer to those four cases though right now, Honourable Chairperson. That was an entry point for my team to just ask you to note that there are implementation problems, and then we'll make a proper referral of those cases. Thank you, Chair.
You want to say something, because the Honourable Members, I think, need their time.
Yes, just a quick one for me. Just in terms of that relationship, I know, Chair, you're a proud Africanist, but there's something that we picked up from the UK ombudswoman when she was here last year, that their system is such that when state organs do not cooperate, she forwards that to the Select Committee, which is your counterparts, saying X and Y is not cooperating or is not implementing the findings, and then the Select Committee or its relevant counterpart will then summon a particular state organ that is not cooperating. Because, for example, we have sometimes challenges. For example, Telkom, for example, has said that we don't have jurisdiction over them. They've issued an opinion over them. But when, for example, the majority stakeholder in Telkom is the Public Investment Corporation, which is public money. So we our position is that, for example, we do have jurisdiction over them. So I would see that, well, my view that in the future is that kind of relationship where if people are not cooperating with us, we have that direct line to you to say, can you please deal with these people one way or the other?
I think that's helpful. I hope you will share that, because you see, if there's non-compliance with your recommendation, instead of you issuing instructions and deadlines for people to comply, as the public protector correctly said, after a report, she's functus. You said functus? Oh, yeah, let me finish. Yeah, functus officio. It means you have done your work, your report is there, and people have received it, they have got to comply. If they don't comply, instead of engaging in a battle with them, you refer that to Parliament, because those people are accountable to Parliament. Parliament is accountable to the people. I think that would smooth our relationship. But I think I like that explanation. I hope you will consider operating that fashion in the future. Thank you very much. I'm opening the floor to the honorable members. Honorable Breitenbach, Honorable Schwart, Honorable Bonga, Honorable Mutapo, Honorable Maila, in that order. Honorable Majake, Honorable Mpumulwana. You can see these are matters of public interest. You can see everyone is going to speak on it. Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the Public Protector and the Office for the report. I noticed from the report that a lot of your targets were not met, and it appears from the explanation in the report that this was largely or exclusively as a result of being under-resourced and underfunded. Can you tell me if that is the major problem that you're experiencing? And B, I see that the your staff members are quite seriously overloaded with work. If you could, I know that in the past you've come to Parliament and asked for more money, and it appears that you haven't received it. And if you could just add a little flesh to why it is that, you know, your staff is so overworked, overburdened with cases. 500 cases per investigator is a huge amount of work. And I see that you've had to let some people go as a lack of funds. So if you could just perhaps go into a little more depth there. And perhaps you could, while you're on that topic of budgetary constraints, how does the fact that your budget is located sort of within the cabinet affect your independence, if at all? If you could just perhaps elaborate on that a little. And is how your requests for funding are dealt with in that regard. And then the act in Section 8 that you referred us to is relatively clear. It says that you can refer your reports to Parliament if you deem it necessary. And I presume that that's a sort of a last resort kind of option, because there are other alternative dispute resolution options also available. So is it your practice to exhaust those first? I'm not too sure that I understand the process. If you could just elaborate on that for me. Thank you.
Very good leading question. Honourable Sean.
Chairperson, there's a quote on page 13 of the report from the SCA judgment that highlights the importance of the public protector, and your chair endorsed that sentiment quite correctly, where it says it provides what will often be a last defence against bureaucratic oppression and against corruption and malfeasance in public office that is capable of insidiously destroying the nation. If that institution falters or finds itself undermined, the nation loses an indispensable constitutional guarantee. I'd like to ask the public protector whether she feels at all whether the office is being undermined, whether she senses that the institution is faltering, whether it's due to whatever factors, in particular you've highlighted the financial considerations, but just particularly the undermining. And I would ask you to comment on, you did indicate Section 9 there's a possibility of a contempt proceedings. Was that with the Deputy Minister of Defence and Veterans, whether that process is ongoing? And then obviously the whole issue of the Nkanda report that is before Parliament, but I think we can discuss principles here. And again, we also have got the issue of the SABC COO report, which is before the Western Cape High Court. It was a great concern to us in the ACDP that the Minister of Communications obtained a legal opinion to say that she could differ from the findings of the public protector and then instituted, and that is now subject to a court case brought by the DA, and we will get clarity on that. But I think the essence of the debate is Section 182.1c, where the public protector takes appropriate remedial action. It's not a recommendation. The recommendation comes, and there could be recommendations. I'd like you to unpack a bit further the way you see it. And to me, it's very clear, and we've had a difference here in Parliament amongst MPs about that. And again, a court will decide on that, Mr. Chair. But surely, where you take appropriate remedial action, that is binding until it is set aside by review, as departments have done and are engaging. And surely, that should also be the process, because the danger of referring, as the chair has indicated, matters to Parliament to follow up is that Parliament might differ from your recommendations itself and from your appropriate remedial action. As state institutions and organs of state, we are obliged to support Chapter 9 institutions. So this is an issue which it's healthy to engage, but I think our view is the law is very clear, the Constitution is clear in 182, but it will be helpful for a court to give that finality at the end of the day. So I'd like your comments in that regard. Thank you very much, Chairperson. I might have just added that I might have to excuse myself due to the financial lock-up as well. Thank you, Chair.
I think, Honourable Short, you have raised very important questions. I don't want to go before they are answered. So with the permission of the other members, I would request that the Office of the Public Protector responds before you go.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and thank you, Honourable Scott. I'm grateful that you have referred to that quote from Judge Nugent, because as we discussed want to attach to the decisions of the flood protector, we have to look at what the FCA has said. As we do so, though, we do so in a context where we understand that there is complementary oversight as part of our constitutional architect. My last slide was to show that the office is not being undermined by the majority of our people.
Can everybody hear?
Honourable members, the last slide that I presented to this committee was to assure this committee, Parliament, and the people of South Africa that the average organ of state not only respects the Constitution, but has compassion for the people who are subjects of injustice. When we sit around the table with people and indicate that you got it wrong here, and this is how you can fix it, in the majority of instances, they did this. That's why we have the Ubuntu case and the poisoned process in the government of Mpumalanga, where it was not just a question of potential corruption, it was also unfairness to the shopholders, to the shop owners that were being unlawfully evicted. However, there is an emerging threat, though. And I single out the case of the Department of Minerals and Energy, where the minister says I've exercised my executive powers and my decision is final. But that's basically them saying no to administrative scrutiny. Because we do understand, honourable members, that everyone has powers that are given to them, but public power is supervised power. My office has had to call upon previous presidents, from President Mandela, President Mbeki, to the current president, and said, you were wrong, sir, in this case, and you do it right. And there has been cooperation in fixing the problem. This parliament, too, was found to have acted wrongly by Advocate Mushwana, and this parliament complied. So much as we account to Parliament, it's a very interesting issue, this issue of checks and balances. We do oversee Parliament itself, though, when it comes to administrative actions of Parliament. We can make findings again in Parliament, and we've never had problems with Parliament, we've never had problems. So it's a few, honourable, and it has to be sorted out. The ones that are taking us to court, we have no problem with that. We do have a problem, though, when, as the one case that we presented to you, the one minister accepted the findings and was in the process of implementing, and then she moved elsewhere. The next minister is supposed to be functus officio because he is in office. Contempt proceedings, yes. We have involved contempt proceedings against a particular minister, Deputy Minister, and he has complied. We have been trying to get meetings to sort out the way forward, the adequacy of what he did in trying to comply, and he's cooperating with us. Because again, it's not in our interest to fight with anyone. It's not in their interest to fight with us. The enemy is maladministration, and if these misunderstanding can be resolved without drama or insult, we all win. If we fight, we create cracks that undermine synergies and allow impunity to happen. On the principles that we've asked about, take appropriate remedial action, I must just indicate again that the Section 39 of the Constitution gives us principles of interpretation. When I was at the South African Law Reform Commission as a full-time member, I supervised many research projects. I was a project leader for interpretation, review of the interpretation of statutes. Again, in interpretation of statutes, you firstly go with the simple, ordinary meaning of words before, if then the words are ambiguous, then you have to use them. For me, it doesn't, this one doesn't look ambiguous, but a court of law will have to determine what it means. But whatever it does, a gate to nowhere is not what Judge Nugget envisages when he says, if that institution falters or finds itself undermined, the nation loses an indispensable constitutional guarantee. It's also not what former President Nelson Mandela had in mind when he issued that statement that is used by ombudsman offices throughout the country. Even the most benevolent of countries do falter, and then he talks about even he has been found to have acted wrongly by this office, and he has complied. That would be my view on it, Honorable. I don't know if I have answered, Honorable. I just also want to say about, we've mentioned the UK ombudsman. The Swedish ombudsman was here with us. One of the things she said, which was said at the IOI conference that I attended a few weeks earlier, is that every ombudsman office functions according to context, according to its context, tradition, and its statute. Many of the old ombudsman offices were created, they are parliamentary ombudsmen, so they act on the authority of parliament, and although their statutes are very specific that they make recommendations, those recommendations are seen as something that has to be complied with. Andre Marin, Ontario Ombudsman, was on Twitter throughout the day 2 days ago. He said virtually all of his findings have been complied with. And his statute specifically says make recommendations. So if we're going to benchmark with UK or any country, it's important in terms of Section 39 of the Constitution that we firstly look at what is their wording. So, for example, the wording says it's a donkey, and our wording says it's a horse. You can't now change the horse to become a donkey just because they come from the same stable of animal. That's basically what I would say on the proposal. So, remedial action is not binding on Parliament, it's binding on the organ of state, because we don't make findings against Parliament, Honourable Chairperson. We make findings against an organ of state that has been involved in acts that we have adjudicated and found to constitute maladministration. The fourth Parliament, which is the parliament that preceded this one, procured an opinion when we did the IEC matter. The opinion, of course, is not a court of law, but the opinion again said when it comes to the findings, parliament cannot change the findings of the public protector. And in the IEC matter, you will note, therefore, that parliament only decided that it would not accede to what I had requested in the letter, but left the report intact.
That means when you decided on a remedial action and the report is before Parliament, Parliament must rubber stamp it, it can't change.
Hey, Honourable Chairperson, the Deputy Public Protector spoke earlier about what happens in the UK, and I would recommend, Chairperson, that we look at what happened in the last four cases. The ombudsman institution differs from country to country But one of the similarities is what happens when these reports go to Parliament. I think that everyone was thinking about it, but you report to Parliament and you say, I investigated, I made findings, I asked this institution to do 1, 2, 3. They are refusing. What normally happens in other countries, and what has happened here with the Auditor General, is the institution that is refusing to implement is then asked to come and explain itself. And then if the institution then suggests that the public protector was unreasonable, the public protector is then called to come to explain herself, to say, in what way is this unreasonable? I just want to indicate, Honorable Chairperson, when you talk about rubber stamping, the public protector is a Chapter 9 institution. It's not the only Chapter 9 institution. So, whatever powers you have in terms of the public protector are the same as you have with the other Chapter 9 institutions. If you can say you can review the findings of the public protector, by implication, you have the power to review the findings of the IEC. By implication, you have the power to review the findings of the Auditor General. I'm just saying because we're dealing with one constitution, one section 181,
You are answering the question. We must find out if the question is answered because we are opening a new debate.
Mr. Chair, I don't agree.
I think it's an important point, but I think she has the public protector has answered well. But it is an important point, the issue of the binding nature. I think we all are interested in that. As far as Chapter 9 institutions go in general. It's a principled approach, it's a constitutional issue. So I think it is helpful for the public protector just to comment on that last aspect. Then my questions will be answered. Thank you, Chair.
He's the author of the question, so that's why I wanted him to say if it's...
Honourable Chairperson, I just want to also explain why I debated, because you said, Chairperson, am I asking Parliament to rubber stamp my decision? So I was responding directly to that, to say, because we're dealing with one chapter of the Constitution, we can't deal with one institution separately from the others, because all of us, in terms of decisional independence, we claim that decisional independence under Section 181 of the Constitution. And there's a Fitzroy judgment that deals with the independence of the judiciary on decisional independence. Again, we report to Parliament on activities, but on decisional independence, that's where we are independent. And normally then in the other countries, and what has happened before is that the symbiotic relationship between us and Parliament is that we perform different functions when we with the ones we investigate. We must recall that Parliament may investigate matters on its own, but when we are the ones we've investigated, Parliament becomes our partner in the enforcement part. But there may be instances where it was Parliament that investigated the matter and made its own findings. But once I stand to be corrected, but once we've made a decision, I cannot see this Parliament saying to the Auditor General, your findings were wrong, say, here are the right findings. Or when the IEC has said the election in this particular area was not free or fair, or I'm red card in so-and-so, and they can't participate because they violated 1, 2, 3, and then they report to this Parliament in their normal way of activities, Parliament can come back and say, no, you were wrong, this is the right decision.
Let's leave that as those as open questions. I think we'll get an appropriate forum to engage in that debate. Honorable Sharta, you covered the next speaker is Honorable Bonga.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. And thanks to the public reporter presentation. I think, Chair, I want to echo your sentiments that we respect the office of the public protector, and we are not doing a favor as we do so. We are actually obliged by the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. The discussion chair about Section 181A, B, and C, I think it's a discussion mainly for our want to venture in it in another day. But I strongly have a view that the Section 181C does not necessarily want any public project to do implementation. It's just to submit the report to Parliament, and Parliament must take it from there. But it will appear to be more of an academic and a constitutional discussion that we may have to take with the public protector and other institutions that support democracy. In terms of the report, Chair, page number 137, it talks about the public protector failure to follow due processes during the appointment of external investigation panel. I would want to get a response of what is happening there in terms of page 137, because there is 70,000 there, that 70,000 reported, and later they are explaining the processes of supply chain related to matters. And I see here that there are issues of non-compliance and issues of irregular expenditure from the office. We want more clarity on those issues. And then, again, Chair, in terms of the King's report, I think King's 2, 3, and this 4 now, on issues of cooperative governance. I would want the public protector to the office to just appraise the committee about exactly, because I think this question borders in the discussion that we've been engaged in, Chair, with the public protector. Exactly where is the public protector reporting? The public protector reporting to the Speaker of Parliament. Who does the itinerary of the public, who approves the itinerary of the public protector? Because recently there were trips to abroad. Who really look at those things and check and determine whether this trip is for personal reasons or is for official reasons? And then page 138. I think there is an issue there also, but the goods and services has increased by 26%. And that may be relating to the trips and so on. So I want the public protector on issues of good governance just to check, is she reporting to the Speaker, is she reporting to, in which office is she reporting, where the air itinerary is signed for trips. And the public protector has received an award recently. I want to just find out whether these awards are as a result of the work that is being done in the office, or are issues that relate to personal issues. And is there any amount attached to these awards? And is proper declarations done? And then, I hear there's a serious issue, Chair, that the public protector is raising about the issues of resources. I want to be appraised about the status of unfunded posts. And of unfunded posts, what is the status there? And I see there's an issue of service providers being procured to do some of the outsourcing of work in the office. So I would want to know what are the financial implications of the external people coming to do some of this work. And finally, I see at page, it's 125 or 126, there was an incident reported, and where the public prosecutor is on record here, that where the son of the public prosecutor had an accident with an official vehicle. And the public prosecutor informed the public that she was to pay these monies from her own personal coffers. Can you get a report? Did the public prosecutor pay those monies? And when were they paid? I think and just to say that I do like the notion about the Gogo Dlamini. I think it's a very encouraging notion, public protector. I think I will just stop there for now. Thank you.
Madam Public Protector, I think the questions by Honorable Breitenbach were not answered. I think because members got interested in the constitutional issues. So I want to suggest that we go out, get a cup of tea, come back, and when we come back, answer Honorable Breitenbach